Welcome to Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later in today's show, we'll discuss a year-long investigation into how one small Texas county has profited over $1 million from the arrest and deportation of undocumented immigrants. But first, we'll discuss the deepening humanitarian crisis in Gaza, followed by Trump's lavish receptions by monarchs in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. In recent weeks, Israel has intensified strikes in Gaza, killing dozens of people, including children and journalists. On Wednesday in Gaza, around 70 Palestinians were reportedly killed overnight in over 10 Israeli airstrikes, which included strikes on two barely functioning hospitals in Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip. And a new UN-backed report says one in five people in Gaza is now facing starvation, with the whole enclave on the brink of famine after nearly 3 months of an Israeli aid blockade. So to get the latest, we are joined by Akbar Shahid Ahmed. Akbar is the senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. He is the author of a forthcoming book on the Biden administration and Gaza, which is titled Crossing the Red Line. Good to have you back with us, Akbar.
Thanks for having me, Ethan.
So we have a lot to talk about, but I want to first start with this humanitarian crisis in Gaza. As I noted, Israel has stepped up its bombing of the Strip, and a new UN-backed report, as I mentioned, warns of widespread famine in Gaza. So just how bad is the situation right now on the ground there?
Ethan, it's unimaginable, right? I've been covering the war since the beginning, since Hamas launched its raid into Israel, killing, you know, over close to 1,200 Israelis, October 7, 2023. In that period, you know, Palestinians have seen horrific things. They've seen orders to leave their homes several times, some of them, you know, more than a dozen times. They've lost family members, all of that. But this last period, in terms of the humanitarian situation, has been inconceivable from what I hear from people on the ground and from aid agencies. And what I mean by that is, for now close to 75 days, Israel has instituted a full blockade. There are no supplies right now that can enter the Gaza Strip. No food, no fuel, no medicine. And that is a policy fully backed by the United States, regardless of the Trump administration's claims he is a peace president. And it's a policy that is a break even with kind of the harshest earlier periods of the war. You know, that even though there were consistently problems with aid delivery, Israel targeting aid workers, issues like that, some trickle of supplies was getting in. Right now, what I hear from people on the ground, one was describing it as no one there can even think about airstrikes, because all they can think about is just their next bite, not even their next meal. So food is running so low, and there's not any kind of sense of a respite on the horizon, because in fact the Israelis are talking about expanding their operation, their military operation on the ground. So not just airstrikes, but in the coming days they're talking about pushing out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were already repeatedly displaced from the north of Gaza back towards the south. This is a situation that's occurred, you know, repeatedly, where people have been forced up and down across this tiny strip of land. And it's important to remember, these people have gotten weaker, more malnourished, more deprived, sicker over that period, right? So moving gets that much harder. Starvation makes you that much weaker. And your chances of dying just because of the conditions you're in are just much, much higher, you know, separate from, of course, the devastating airstrikes on Friday. Just today, we've seen close to 100 people killed in U.S.-backed Israeli airstrikes.
Well, it just sounds horrific there. And what do you think is Israel's endgame here? Do they have one that they've stated publicly? Do you have any sense of what they're ultimately really trying to accomplish here?
You know, Ethan, it's kind of helpful to think about two broad goals for the Israeli offensive in Gaza. One is returning home the Israeli hostages who Hamas and other Palestinian militants did take violently, viciously, in violation of international law on October 7th, 2023. Right? So that's kind of been a stated goal. There were close to 250 hostages. Now there are about 20 or so still alive. And then there are corpses. Of course, but military pressure has very, very rarely been the way that hostages have been brought back, right? A small number have been brought back that way, but the vast majority have been brought back when there have been ceasefires or truces between Israel and Hamas, usually brokered by the United States. The mood inside Israel right now is very, very dark, with kind of the advocates for those hostages, specifically the Hostage Families Forum, said this is the miss of the century for Israel to choose in this moment to ramp up its offensive instead of saying, we've done so much damage, let's cut a deal now. Because certainly from the US, we can get into this a little more. From the Trump administration, there's a little bit of an interest in a deal. It's not translated into meaningful pressure. The other Israeli goal that we need to remember is the kind of maximalist goal, right? So the idea of eliminating Hamas forever, which is a really, it's a big goal. You know, this is an organization that not only ruled Gaza for close to 20 years, but has deep, deep roots there. As experts in national security will often say, you can't kill an ideology, right? And particularly as Israel's US-backed offensive has been so punishing, Hamas recruitment has actually gone up in the Gaza Strip. Most of the people, most of the fighters, militants Israel has killed have been replaced by new recruits. But that said, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu leads a right-wing, pretty kind of aggressive government, including many kind of far-right ministers who not only are saying we will not stop short of getting every last Hamas militant, are talking about things like the reoccupation of Gaza, which gets into really thorny questions of international law, ethnic cleansing of Palestinians out of the Strip permanently, and these ideas of bringing Israelis back in to live in Gaza. President Trump has expressed some openness to that as well, of course, with his notorious Mara Gaza rhetoric, this idea he'll kind of develop a beach resort there. So there's a really chilling and quite dark, bloody vision as well.
And why do you think the war in Gaza seems to not be getting more attention at this point? There was obviously a lot of news coverage when the war first broke out, but at this point, it feels like the attention has been waning, and especially at this moment with of this humanitarian crisis. What do you make of the media coverage right now?
I think there's several streams for that. I think a really important one is the chilling effect that the Trump administration has imposed on any discussion of Israel-Palestine over the last 4 months, right? You've seen this in the crackdowns on students being detained, being jailed for op-eds. And that really has a kind of ripple effect across society, right? In terms of how people are willing to talk about this, how paranoid people are about their Instagram posts or their social media posts, or just even talking about it to the wrong person and facing professional consequences. I think that does extend to media in that this is an administration that's shown a really clear vengeful instinct towards news outlets that don't report the way it would like. And so with media owners, Jeff Bezos, you know, most notoriously, but others, including the owner of the LA Times, who just traveled to Saudi Arabia with President Trump, with a lot of kind of owners of big media corporations thinking, well, we have business interests before the Trump administration. I think it has gotten harder. You've seen this also in kind of a departure from 60 Minutes over a documentary on Gaza. So there's that effect. And then I think just broadly thinking about how the US engages with its often quite sadly quite destructive role in the broader world. I think for Americans, wars as they approach the 2 year mark can feel like the weather, right? As well as well, they just hate each other, they're going to kill each other, and I need to sort of check out. But of course, what we know from the record of this war is that it is a man-made crisis. There are specific decisions on humanitarian aid that are causing starvation that could be changed. And there are specific decisions to continue military support that, again, could change and could dramatically improve the situation. But I think because people feel such a sense of, well, a lot has been tried, but a lot really hasn't changed over this close to 2 years. And I think an actual reconsideration of the policy has not occurred from the between the Biden and Trump administrations. And so there's a sense of futility.
Well, we're speaking with Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, and the author of a forthcoming book on the Biden administration and Gaza titled Crossing the Red Line. And we are speaking about the situation in Gaza on Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and the phone lines are now open. We would love to hear from you if you have questions for Akbar about what is going on in the Middle East right now, if you have thoughts or perspectives to share about what is happening in Gaza in this broader Middle East political dynamics with the Trump administration and Trump's trip this week out to the region. We'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or go ahead and send your question or comment by email to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Akbar, let's shift gears a little bit and just talk about Trump's visit to the region this week. It's been getting a lot of coverage, and I'm curious what you make of the media coverage and how you would assess the trip that Trump took.
It's a really significant trip in that it reminds us, I think someone put it as, you know, the Middle East is Donald Trump's safe space, right? It reminds us he feels so comfortable with these foreign wealthy dictators, right, who often mix the professional, the public, and the private in their dealings with him, whether it's through his real estate interests in the region. It's all mixed in with how he's approaching policymaking. I do think, you know, I did a big piece that folks can read on Donald Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, who's a close personal friend of his, a fellow kind of real estate billionaire. And what I heard from regional sources and from U.S. officials dealing with this was, look, it's quite clear, of course, that Trump is very transactional. You're not going to get talk about human rights in Saudi Arabia. You're not going to get talk about America's moral vision for the world. But they feel that there are deals that can be done, right? And there is flexibility there. There's unconventional thinking. And what we have seen is that Trump and his envoy, Steve Witkoff, in several ways have shaped U.S. policy in the Middle East, not always through the lens of what Israel prefers, which for a lot of regional governments is a breath of fresh air. And they feel is not just kind of what they want at a personal level, but strategically important, right? Their argument is you need to be boosting U.S. influence in this region to deal with the risk of Chinese influence. You can achieve a lot just by being a little more open-minded, a little more flexible. And the example of this, the most significant diplomatic episode of this trip, was Donald Trump meeting with the Syrian leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, who took over Syria in December after deposing the former dictator Bashar Assad. There was a lot of questions about would Trump actually go through with meeting with him? You know, and it's something that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not want, and also did not want Trump to lift U.S. sanctions on Syria. He sees Sharaa as a potential security threat to Israel. More broadly, some U.S. officials talked to me and said, look, Israel just wants a kind of weak Syria. It doesn't want to see a Syria that's getting rebuilding, that's free of U.S. sanctions on its borders. And Trump did meet the Syrian leader in Saudi Arabia, which was very much what the Saudis and some other regional players wanted. And he announced not only some sanctions relief, he said he would lift all U.S. sanctions. So that's a really significant shift, I think, which shows to an extent as Trump has these really unconventional dealings. And when I say unconventional, I mean his envoy Witkoff, I revealed in my feature on him, you know, will be on WhatsApp with these leaders for 2 to 3 hours a day. No one knows what's happening in those conversations. Mm-hmm. He had in one instance a 10-hour meeting with the leader of the United Arab Emirates, no official record, right? So it's a very unconventional and potentially dysfunctional approach to regional diplomacy. But to an extent, it's delivering on some fronts. You know, you've seen the Houthis in Yemen agree to stop hitting American ships, even though Trump did not force them to stop hitting Israeli ships. You saw an Israeli-American hostage from the Hamas attack released earlier this week. And I'll just very quickly also note Iran diplomacy, I think, is very important. Trump has also shown flexibility on pursuing an agreement really similar to the nuclear deal that President Barack Obama and other international governments negotiated with Iran back in 2015 to give Iran some sanctions relief in exchange for limiting its nuclear program. Trump tore that up. Now he and Witkoff seem to really have a lot of interest and are doing a lot of work to reinvigorate those options and are very openly saying we don't want to pursue a war with Iran, which again is Israel's preference right now.
And if you're just joining us, this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're talking about Trump's trip to the Middle East this week, as well as the situation on the ground in Gaza. We're joined by Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. And the phone lines are open. If you have questions about what's happening in the Middle East right now, about Trump's trip to the Middle East, the number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. And Akbar, you mentioned Steve Witkoff, this envoy to the Middle East. Can you give us a little more background on him? Who is he? Why did Trump pick him?
Yeah, so Witkoff is a really he's a someone described the Trump administration to me this week as a personalist regime, and Witkoff in so many ways embodies that. His power flows not from any deep foreign policy expertise or, years of success in the region. It's the fact that Donald Trump really likes him, talks to him. They've been personally close. Witkoff was in the courtroom with Trump as Trump was facing the cases, if you recall, over sexual assault allegations against him, various other criminal charges he faced. Witkoff was on the golf course with Trump when there was an assassination attempt against him. So there's a really deep personal link, and he travels around the Middle East, notably on his own private jet, not a government plane. He travels around the Middle East very much with the authority of the president, and so I think that's a reason why regional interlocutors like dealing with him. He is seen as, while he's close to the president, he doesn't have a lot of those kind of concerning traits of Trump, whether it's being whether it's just being kind of rude, frankly. I mean, he's seen as quite diplomatic and suave. All that said, Witkoff also embodies the way in which there's a lack of transparency. I mentioned the, meetings that one source described to me as a black hole. He's had similar meetings with Russian President Vladimir Putin. He also embodies the potential for corruption. Witkoff has done business in the Middle East with many of these wealthy Gulf Arab monarchies, particularly Qatar, for decades. And there's a real risk, there's a risk of ethical concerns of US officials, just taking bribes, right? This question of Trump's luxury jet from Qatar has become a big one this week. But that also has really clear, beyond the moral concerns around that has really clear strategic implications, because if you are basing your policy based on potentially corrupt desires or your sense that you just want to give your interlocutor a win because you have so many other interests before them, are you necessarily cutting the right deal that will ensure stability, that will secure American interests, that will kind of pursue these broader goals, whether it's of trade, whether it's of, to a degree, human rights protections and values? That's what's unclear. And I think a lot of observers still don't know if the Witkoff deals, right now, the region is really waiting on a lot of Witkoff deals on Iran, potentially on Gaza. He's the lead person on Gaza as well. Whether those will be really comprehensive and meaningful deals, or kind of wins that are really put out to just provide a good PR boost for the president. And I think I just also note that Witkoff is deeply involved in a really controversial and alarming so-called humanitarian proposal for Gaza, which would replace the existing aid system, or what's left of it, with a system backed by American private security contractors. That's really alarming to the UN, to other aid workers who've operated in Gaza for years, know the lay of the land. They say it violates neutrality, and it also risks, Palestinians just not feeling willing to work with that institution, that process, and many of them being left out. So there's a lot of concerns around with that as well.
Well, and I know that organization is called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, as you mentioned, supposed to be providing aid through private security contractors. Can you talk to us more about what this foundation might mean for the people in Gaza and who exactly in the administration seems to be pushing for it?
Yeah, so it's the concern for people in Gaza is that it The pitch from this so-called foundation involves Palestinians traveling across the strip to various hubs once a week to get a small amount of supplies and then going back to wherever they're taking shelter. There's huge problems just in that small process because it raises questions of who will these contractors, and this is a plan very much supported by Israel, so we have to think of it chiefly in that way. Who will Israel decide? Who among Palestinians will be disqualified from receiving aid, maybe because of links to Hamas? That's not how humanitarian aid is supposed to work, right? That's not how you support a broader community, especially in a place where Hamas has been instituted as a militant group, but also a political organization. So there's that question. There's a question of the really minimal amount of aid that this plan imagines giving a family per week. They're talking about less than $2 worth of supplies, which is it's the bare minimum and probably below that. And then there's this question of, do you really want to be relying on untrained, inexperienced military contractors, given the experience of the US war on terror, where Blackwater was terrorizing civilians in Iraq, given experiences around is the difficulties of Israeli troops themselves dealing with Palestinians, which we've seen in the occupied West Bank as well. In terms of who's pushing for it, it is to a degree the Israeli government. It's some hardliners here in the US, and there isn't a big push back against it within the administration, which I think tells us quite a lot about, do they just want a headline again to say, we did something different, we're helping the people of Gaza, stop talking about starvation?
And as we think about the look at the coverage of this trip, a lot of it has been about its potential rift, so-called rift between the US and Israel. And as you mentioned, there was this talk with the Syrian president lifting of sanctions, which was something that Israel did not want. Also, the deal with Yemen, these ongoing talks with Iran that seem to be signals of a break, some kind of break between US and Israel. Is that accurate? What do you make of that media theme?
I think that it's funny because it echoes in some ways, right, of the Biden era, where every 2 weeks, maybe more frequently, you would see stories saying President Biden has had it up to here with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Biden is so enraged with Netanyahu. I think that we in the media could be a little smarter about the tangible aspects of U.S. policy, right? So it's not just the mood music of. I do believe, and I know from my sources, that Witkoff certainly is quite unhappy with Netanyahu. Trump has seems to have expressed some disdain for Netanyahu as well. But in a tangible way, the US-backed blockade of Gaza is ongoing. The US-backed airstrikes are ongoing. So I think the way that I think a more accurate framing would put it is the US has shown a willingness to break with Israel. But it's not by no means stepping away from being Israel's greatest patron as it pursues a policy that the US has said, is unlikely to achieve its own aims. So it's a self-contradictory position to be in. There's another way of looking at it, which is a question of, is Gaza kind of the price? Are Palestinians paying the price for the Trump administration's willingness to challenge Israel on other fronts? And so I think those are kind of more accurate, nuanced framings than just saying there's a break with Israel.
And Akbar, as you do your reporting on what's happening in the Trump administration versus the Biden administration on these Middle Eastern issues in particular, I'm curious your experience between the two administrations. How has your access to officials been with this administration versus the Biden administration? How has your job changed in terms of how you're able to cover these stories?
In my experience so far, on these specific issues, Trump administration officials have seemed willing to engage with the press and to a degree. I think by the Biden administration, because they were so frustrated with their own policy, often became really aggressive towards the press, pretty early into the war. So far, it doesn't seem. So far, there's a little more openness in this era, at least in how they're dealing with reporters. Biden administration figures, of course, are out here defending their legacy, saying, we did the best we could. At the time, they were often kind of misleading the press by saying that it was progress on a ceasefire for Gaza that wasn't actually happening. And they were frequently privately harassing individual reporters, me, but other colleagues, for coverage that they found, there was an expectation that they could shape and influence the coverage. And I haven't felt that yet from the Trump administration in that same aggressive way.
It also seems like there perhaps are fewer leaks now, at least than what we saw in the first Trump administration, and also a number of resignations that happened early in this first 100 days here, but have now seem to taper off. So do you get a sense that they've sort of successfully, purged the people they don't want speaking and deliberating about their policies, and have now sort of consolidated their hold over the bureaucracy that you cover?
I think it's to an extent there's a self-selecting group of people, yes, who've left, but there's a really deep kind of bureaucratic bench, right? And I think that there are hundreds, maybe probably thousands of people who are not necessarily ideologically aligned with Trump or stylistically, but who are staying in the bureaucracy to try to affect change that they can. But there is, of course, there's a huge chilling effect, and this goes back to what I said about the administration's desire to pursue and crack down on media. There's a huge chilling effect among people who would potentially talk to journalists because I think they know that this administration, more than the Biden administration, will seek out people. And they know that specifically the issue of Israel-Palestine and claims of anti-Semitism have really been weaponized by the administration to a huge extent to pursue critics outside government, so why would they not use it for critics inside government? There is a lot of fear, in the Biden administration, there was a lot of dissent inside the State Department that I covered, and the State Department Secretary of State Tony Blinken, to his credit, did consistently say, "We value different opinions. Please offer your opinion. There will be no retribution." And there wasn't, there wasn't a campaign of professional retaliation. I think having that kind of internal dissent right now would be harder. That said, in actual deliberations, policy deliberations, because there's far less convention and there's far less deference to Israel, certainly, I do think the new ideas may be being discussed in ways that they weren't in the Biden era.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I have to ask you before we let you go, just what are you following next? What could we expect from you in terms of reporting, and what are the big issues that you're tracking that might relate to that reporting?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm following, some of these streams that you talked about with the professional bureaucracy versus Trump appointees, how that's working, how particularly foreign policy officials are feeling about taking some of these shifts and implementing them. I'm also following this really interesting question of who gets to define the legacy of Donald Trump's foreign policy. I think there's a real war for the soul of Trump's foreign policy among traditionalist Republican hawks, some folks who describe themselves as restrainers or more diplomacy-minded, like Vice President J.D. Vance. And that battle, I think, will really deepen, particularly over the Iran negotiations, which I'll just note, people should know that the Iran negotiations really have to lead to a deal within 6 weeks or so, or there's a real risk of increased tensions and potentially war.
Well, a lot to look forward to in terms of reading and following this news, and really appreciate your ongoing coverage of it and for coming on Your Calls Media Roundtable to talk about what's going on in the Middle East right now. Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for the Huffington Post and author of the forthcoming book on the Biden administration in Gaza called Crossing the Red Line. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And coming up after this short break, we're going to turn to a New York Times investigation about a Texas county that has been profiting off of the bail payments by migrants who were later deported. So that's coming up next after this short break.